In the fall of 2003, Detective Lou Sala from Cook County Sheriff's Cold Case Division began his search for Michael Gargiulo, the last name on the list of potential witnesses to the Tricia Boccaccio murder in 1993. He tracked Gargiulo to California, where he'd been living since 1998. Eventually, they connected with LAPD Detective Tom Small, who was also looking into Gargiulo for possible connections to the murder of 22-year-old Ashley Ellerin in Hollywood. Let's bring back Tom Small. Tom, how did that connection happen?
The way Chicago got involved was, I had no idea that he was being looked at for anything in Illinois until October of 2002. And I received a phone call from Lou Sala and indicated that they were requesting our assistance in locating a witness because they needed to get some DNA to rule this witness out as a participant in a case that they were investigating. So I said, well, okay, yeah, we can help you out. You got a name on this guy? Maybe I'd do some work up on him and we can meet. And they said, yeah, his name's Mike Gargiulo. And I just about dropped my jaw, dropped the phone. I looked at my partner. I said, did you hear that? And I said, can you guys get over here like real quick? And they said, yeah, we're just down the street from you. So they showed up and I already had a picture of Gargiulo and I put it out. Is this the guy you're looking for? He says, yeah. How'd you get that so fast? I says, I'm looking for him too. I said, what kind of case do you have? They said, well, we're investigating a 1993 murder of a young gal that was stabbed to death. And I said, well, that's ironic. I says, I'm investigating a similar kind of murder. What do you know about this guy? He says, well, he was best friends with their murder victim's brother. And he only lived like a block away. I said, well, that's unique. How was she killed? And they described it, and it had very close similarities in the targeting, the fact that she was not raped or sexually assaulted in any way. It was a purposeful killing. Multiple stab wounds in the same general areas that Ashley had hers. So the MO was very similar. I said, well, we're going to have to collaborate on this one because I'm looking for this guy. He's a murder suspect. And they were only looking at him as a potential witness at the time because they had somebody else they were looking to put this on, the Glenview, Illinois murder from 93. And this whole thing kind of changed their whole game plan and direction. So that's how we got involved with Chicago. And there was some back and forth. They came out a couple of times. I went to Chicago a few times and, worked up the cases, interviewed a bunch of people, got background on Gargiulo. It turns out Gargiulo was born and raised in Glenview, Illinois, which is a Chicago suburb. And, he lived literally a block away. And so ultimately, we kept working the cases together, and then I found out about another case in Downey, California. And they had a similar murder of a young lady in her kitchen. And so we collaborated with them and did I think it was 2004, if I'm not mistaken. We actually worked with Illinois, Chicago, and Downey to get Gargiulo in for interview.
Los Angeles and Cook County detectives eventually tracked down Gargiulo to an apartment listed under the name of his new girlfriend on Clark Drive. Armed with a search warrant, they found and searched his van. Tom, how did you track Gargiulo down?
Well, we tracked him down initially because he was seen by a guy by the name of Justin Peterson, who was Ashley's first roommate and a very close friend of hers. And he reported one night to coming home, Justin did, about 1:30 in the morning. And he was on foot. And he walked past the building that Mark Durbin lives in, which is, I believe, Sarah Bonita Street, which it runs into Pinehurst Road and past the dog park. And he sees a green Chevy S10 pickup. The engine is running and there's somebody inside. He makes a mental note of the plate. And he looks in there and he sees a big crucifix hanging from the rearview mirror. And as he's passing the truck, he sees Mike Gargiulo. And he says, "That's Mike." And it really freaked him out because he was going to spend the night there on Pinehurst at Ashley's place. Ashley was gone at the time, and it was just him staying there. And then all of a sudden he starts getting some very early phone calls, like 5:36 in the morning, and it's Mike, and he's looking for Ashley. And Justin tells him, "She's not here. I'll take a message." And then he looks out the window, Justin does, and he sees the Chevy S10 that he saw the night before making passes up and down Pinehurst looking at the house. Gargiulo is looking at the house and eventually stops the truck, gets out, comes on the front porch and bangs on the door. And Justin opens the door, but Gargiulo, he doesn't talk from the porch. He just barges in. And it really unnerved Justin because Gargiulo was looking room to room to see if she was actually there, and she wasn't. So he left. He didn't say anything. He just left. So Justin confirmed the plate number, gave it to me. I actually gave it to his mother, and his mother suggested giving it to a private investigator. And ultimately it got to me, and I ran it, and it turned out to be some woman that lived out in Diamond Bar, which is 30-some miles east of L.A., and it was a vehicle owned by this lady who lived with her parents. This lady's in her 30s. And it was consistent with some of the later moves that we found that Gargiulo makes, where he uses vehicles that belong to other people, or he lives in apartments that are actually leased by other people. And so that was the story. So I ran that down. And I came up with several other potential locations. So ultimately, I wrote a multi-location search warrant for all these places and these vehicles. And I was looking for specifically Gargiulo or anything that indicates that he lives there or stays there. Plus, requesting that the judge authorize a search, a location search for him physically and for his blood, hair, and saliva. And so the judge granted that, and we did a simultaneously a search execution on three locations, and we were able to locate Gargiulo, who was coming out of an alley, luckily at the time that the officers were there, because we were inside the location to be searched, and he happened to come back to it. So he obviously saw we were cops, and he tried to charge through and escape. But four coppers took him down, indicated that we had a search warrant. He was going to go with us to provide hair, saliva, and blood. Of course, he didn't want to do that. And they said, "Well, you don't have much choice, so you can go easy or go hard." And he decided to go hard, so that's the way we handled it. And we got all that done. I booked the evidence, and I was able to provide samples to ship from our crime lab to to the Cook County Sheriff's Police Lab for their analysis and comparisons to their crime scene as well. And that's where we got the hit.
LAPD Detective Michael Pelletier later testified that while Gargiulo was in custody, he asked officers, "What if my DNA was on a keychain that was left at a crime scene?" And according to Pelletier, he remarked, "They can't find my DNA from 10 years ago at a crime scene, can they?" Wondering if they could book him for his hairs being found at a crime scene in Chicago. When Michael Pelletier asked Gargiulo what he was talking about, he replied, "Never mind." Let's bring in DNA expert Dr. Kristen Middleman. Dr. Middleman, can you explain the process for standard DNA testing in 2003?
So in 2003, the system that was in place for forensic DNA testing was the CODIS system here in the United States, which means that detectives would have collected DNA from the crime scene, and then they would have used a standard forensic DNA test that allows for a profile that has 20 STR markers. Then that profile would be compared to the CODIS database, which is the database that law enforcement has that includes all of the known perpetrators in the United States. So in order for you to make it into CODIS, you have to be already convicted of a crime and put into CODIS. And so, unfortunately, a lot of us know that many perpetrators are not, they don't have their DNA in CODIS already, and you may get no match. Or you may have a perpetrator's DNA in CODIS, but you just don't have their identity to link to. What can happen now, decades later, is there's this new technology called forensic-grade genome sequencing, and that's building a profile that has hundreds and hundreds of thousands of markers, so not just 20, but hundreds and hundreds of thousands from that type of DNA. And then you're able to upload that profile to genealogical databases consented for law enforcement use, and that allows you to get really distant relationships. Seventh cousins, sixth cousins, the more markers you have in the profile, the more distant the relationships are that you can capture. Being able to capture all those relationships allows us to be able to fit the unknown DNA sample into a family tree and to let law enforcement know or infer the identity of that person and let law enforcement know that lead. Then law enforcement can go back to that person, obtain their DNA, like they did in this case when they got his DNA sample, and compare it using standard DNA technology to confirm that it's certainly a match with the technology that's gone to court all of this time. So it's like a double confirmation. But the amazing part is if you don't know someone's identity, but they left DNA at a crime scene, you can still infer it years later. Now, the question that you asked was, can you go back 10 years and get DNA from the crime scene? We've worked crimes all the way back to the 1800s, right? So it depends on how the DNA was left. It depends on if there was blood, if there was just touch DNA, what was there and how it was swabbed and how it was collected or how it was maintained or kept. But there are multiple cases a week that we announce where we've gone back to sex assaults from 62 years ago, murders from 47 years ago, and have been able to use trace amounts of DNA left at the crime scene and still identify who left that DNA. So that's the other part of the advancements that have come through DNA technology over the last few years. What was possible 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is very different from what's possible today. DNA detection technologies, the inputs that you can take in and build a profile for that help you lead to someone's identity, have expanded exponentially. We have now been able to identify a perpetrator from really difficult mixtures, even down to 0.12 nanograms of DNA. That is about 15 human cells. It was a mixture of perpetrator and victim, and it was 32 years old. But that was enough for us to be able to tell who that perpetrator was, and CODIS linked him to yet another crime that he had gotten away with 3 years before. I hope that answers your question.
Let's bring back Tom Small. Tom, what happened after police took Gargiulo's DNA sample?
We got a DNA hit on Tricia Picaccio's fingernails. Under her fingernails was a blood-like substance that came back to Mike Gargiulo. And I remember that it was a really high, it's a thing, in those years they call it RFLP. I don't remember what that stands for, but it's a process of DNA. And it was 1 in 97 million chance that it would be anybody else. I think it was more than 97 million. I think it was more like 97 billion. It was a very high number that you couldn't replicate in life in this world. So it was definitely Gargiulo. Unfortunately for me, I couldn't link him DNA-wise to my crime scene. I could link him by way of circumstances. And I had a lot of that by observations of my witnesses, things that came directly out of Gargiulo's mouth, two people, that type of thing. Plus, as it turns out, his MO and his signatures on these other cases matched up very closely to my case. So we were able to pin that all down there. But now Illinois had a case. So that the Ellerin case basically firmed up and made their case. So they just had to act on that and move forward.
With DNA testing now linking Michael Gargiulo to Tricia Picaccio, detectives could bring the case to Cook County prosecutors to recommend charges for Gargiulo. But since there was no DNA evidence recovered from Ashley Ellerin's crime scene, LAPD and Detective Tom Small had to rely on Illinois prosecutors to indict Gargiulo and hopefully get him off the street. The Cook County State Attorney at the time was Dick Devine, with Scott Cassidy serving as special prosecutor. Let's bring back investigative journalist Doug Longini. You've covered this part of the case closely. What happened when Cook County prosecutors were presented with DNA evidence for Tricia Picaccio?
Enough DNA was found on Tricia Picaccio's fingernails to move ahead on the case, it seemed. There was Tricia's DNA, but there was also DNA from Michael Gargiulo on the fingernails. So the detectives, who'd been pushing the case properly at that moment in 2003, detectives including Lou Sala, went to the Cook County prosecutors with this new DNA evidence, expecting, anticipating, convinced that they'd solve the case, and expecting Cook County State's Attorney's Office to bring charges against Michael Gargiulo based upon the DNA match. The Cook County State's Attorney said they would not prosecute, that they did not have enough evidence. Like, what do you mean they don't have enough evidence? They had DNA that on Trish's, or from Trish's fingernails, showed Michael had Michael Gargiulo's DNA. How can you not bring him in and charge him? Well, here were the reasons why. Or here's the reasons they gave at the time. When that DNA evidence was, when those fingernails were first nipped off of Trish's fingers, there were 8 fingernails from her left hand and her right hand. They were swabbed, not by the procedural standard at the time. They should have been swabbed, one swab doing the tops of the fingernails, one swab doing the underside of the fingernails. No. Remember, I've described a Cook County Police Department that was, let's just say, not the best. It was one swab that was used. Okay, and we'll get to why that's important. Then the 8 fingernails both from the right hand and the left hand, were all put in the one envelope. And that envelope sat for almost a decade. So, of course, some of the, as was testified in court, some of that DNA would have deteriorated over time. Nonetheless, there was Teresa's DNA and Michael Gargiulo's DNA. The Cook County prosecutors told Detective Lou Sala and the others working on the investigation, all of them, these detectives, convinced that they'd solved the case. We're going to bring Michael Gargiulo to justice and find justice for Teresa. The prosecutors explained that Michael Gargiulo's DNA could have ended up on Trisha's fingernails from casual contact. They pointed out, incorrectly, that Michael Gargiulo was a friend of Doug Boccaccio's. Michael Gargiulo had been in the Boccaccio home over the years many times. Shortly before Trisha's murder, Trisha had gotten to ride in one of the Gargiulo's family vans. Many days of the week, Diane Boccaccio would drive her son Doug and Michael Gargiulo to high school. So they'd been in, Michael Gargiulo had been in the, at least one of the Boccaccio's car. So Cook County State's attorney said they could not rule out casual contact, and therefore they would not bring charges against Michael Gargiulo. That would have profound and tragic consequences.
Let's bring back DNA expert, Dr. Kristen Middleman. Dr. Middleman, can you explain more about casual contact and how it relates to DNA evidence from a victim's fingernails?
Absolutely. So as DNA technology improves and improves and becomes more and more sensitive, where you're able to identify someone from such trace amounts of DNA, touch DNA, you have to start to consider whether all the DNA collected at a crime scene is truly probative. And that's where the investigative part of the process is so important and so critical. So a seasoned detective that has worked many, many of these cases has a really good idea of what is probative and what is not probative at a crime scene, or what could be and what couldn't be probative in a crime scene. That's probably not a call that someone that is working a DNA in a DNA lab should be making. It's more of a call that the detective should make based on the type of evidence that was collected. And let me give you some examples. If the DNA was trace amounts, but it was semen or it was blood found at the crime scene, that indicates that it's likely that there was either a some sort of physical disagreement between two people, and maybe the victim was able to scratch the perpetrator during the attack and got blood under her fingernails, or was able to, the perpetrator injured himself while he was stabbing the victim. Or obviously when you leave seminal fluids at a crime scene, that's something that isn't just casual contact, even if it's found in trace amounts. So the type of DNA is one clue that gives you the ability to say that's probative. Unfortunately, when you're talking about just touch DNA, and sometimes that's all that's left, you have to consider the location of that touch DNA. If it's touch DNA around someone's throat and the manner of death was strangulation, well, that's something that's considered probative most of the time. If it's touch DNA on someone's clothing, well, you could have hugged your best friend, or you could have hugged somebody the day before that day or touched them. Is that a probative piece of DNA for the crime scene? Probably not, right? Those are the decisions that are being made by law enforcement. In this case, it obviously fell in the gray zone because the DNA was found under her fingernails. But the DNA that was found under her fingernails, I'm not sure if it belonged to just skin cells, epithelial cells, or touch DNA, or if it was something that was derived from blood. That's something that you guys can look at in the reports. But for whatever reason, the prosecutors determined that that wasn't suffice to proceed. And so it wasn't necessarily probative. And that's how that determination is usually made. And that's what happened in this case.
It's very insightful. Thank you. According to investigators, there was almost a 50-50 mixture of Tricia and Gargiulo's DNA under her fingernails. Can you explain what that means?
Yes. So the percentage of the mixture, so when you say a 50-50 mixture, that means there's equal parts of the victim and the perpetrator in that DNA sample. So often on crime scenes, the perpetrator DNA is at much lower concentration than the victim's DNA because you're working with the victim's body. A 50-50 mixture means that there was quite a bit of his DNA under her fingernails when they swabbed her fingernails. Again, this was not found probative, so it's likely that it could have been epithelial DNA. I mean, you can imagine if someone was, you know, you shake someone's hand or you touch someone and your fingernails accidentally get some of their cells underneath your nails, it didn't necessarily mean that that happened during a crime. And I think that was the argument that was made in the articles that I read, is that there was no way to prove that the cells were there because of the crime or were actually probative to the crime. Again, likely because it wasn't found in blood.
Doctor, what were your thoughts on Cook County's decision not to prosecute?
I don't know any prosecutors, and I've worked with hundreds of them in the last few years, that don't want to prosecute someone for a crime they committed. They have to go into court certain that this person committed that crime. And sometimes, even with all the science and all the tools that we hand them, that certainty is not necessarily there. And they're having to make a call based on what is all the other investigations they've ever been part of and all the other types of DNA evidence they have seen at crime scenes and they have seen prosecuted successfully through court. And when you make calls like that that are not based on science but are based on being able to analyze a crime scene and having to infer whether something is probative or not, you're not going to be 100% right, even if you're the best prosecutor in the United States of America. And so I understand the outrage that people have, especially because this person got away with a crime and then continued to commit more crimes until he got caught. But in the United States of America, we expect certainty when a prosecutor takes someone to court. We're innocent until proven guilty. And they were looking for DNA evidence that was more probative because there were some bodily fluids. There was something that was directly linked to a crime. And so, in my opinion as a DNA expert, is that is their job. And so they have to be allowed the opportunity to do their job the best they can. And I believe that is what happened here as well.
Doctor, you bring up a really good point. In the court of law, you're innocent till proven guilty. That's key. Let's bring in attorney Joshua Ritter, criminal defense attorney, former Los Angeles County deputy district attorney. Josh, what are your thoughts on how Cook County prosecutors handled this case? Are you surprised they refused to charge Gargiulo based on the evidence they had?
I completely understand and sympathize with the frustration that law enforcement and the family members have had with the hesitation on the part of Cook County prosecutors to bring charges in this case. But I think it's important to really look at this with a sense of nuance and understanding of what really the responsibility of a prosecutor is. Because it's not an easy call for them to make. A lot goes into the decision on whether or not to charge someone, especially for something of this magnitude. You're talking about murder. We're not talking about some low-level crime. We're talking about murder. And they are not only tasked with the idea of trying to figure out who is responsible, but can they hold that person responsible? In other words, can they bring charges that will get past certain legal hurdles and to the point of being able to prove those charges beyond a reasonable doubt at trial? So that is my long-winded introduction to saying that to some extent, I'm not surprised. Yes, DNA is powerful evidence, but it's also important to remember that DNA remains circumstantial evidence. And what I mean by that is it's not direct evidence in the sense that an eyewitness saw what took place or videotape captured what took place. All DNA is telling us is that one person was in contact with another person at some point in time. We can't even pinpoint when that took place or how that contact was made. So the prosecutors here sounds like they had a real problem with the DNA being, first of all, touch DNA, meaning that it was not blood or some other type of bodily fluid that you could absolutely say that this was more than casual contact. It was touch DNA. And that this was a person that the victim had reason to perhaps be in contact with. Now, I know there's a bunch of arguments against that. There's the idea that she was in contact with many other people that evening. She didn't have their DNA on her. That there was no evidence that she had come into contact with this person anytime in the recent future. And all of that, I think, makes a lot of sense. And all of that, I think, played into the decision matrix. But it still comes down to a very difficult decision. And the decision isn't one of, do they believe this person is responsible, as much as with what they have in hand, the evidence they have in hand, do they believe that they could prove this beyond a reasonable doubt? And I think that's a much more nuanced and difficult question to answer. And I think why it led to the very frustrating decision that they made.
Josh, can you explain why a prosecutor wouldn't try to prosecute a case like this? Is it not worth trying for the sake of Tricia Picaccio's parents who have gone 10 years without answers?
Prosecutors are, to a great extent, gatekeepers. They are not just tasked with the idea of putting the bad guys away and, you know, hard charging, you know, pursuit of justice. Part of their job is to make sure that not only are they charging guilty people, but they're making sure to not charge people who are either innocent or people that they feel they cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt in front of 12 individuals that this person is responsible. So there is this gatekeeping element, the idea that they have to make sure that justice, in the sense that the right person is being charged with the right evidence. But they're also concerned about what happens if you do give this a try? What happens if you say, let's just give it a shot? This family deserves some answers. They've had an incredible loss. It's been a long period of time. We believe we know who did it. Let's just put it in front of 12 people and see what happens. Well, the consequences of that could be an acquittal. And that could be disastrous if you think about it, because now double jeopardy has attached. Now you've brought a case to trial where you didn't have sufficient evidence. Perhaps you've got some very clever and skilled defense attorneys who were able to exploit some of the holes in your evidence. That touch DNA could be one of them. They could have reasons they could present to the jury that might explain why that DNA was there that didn't have to do with the murders. And if jurors felt that that was not enough to surmount that hurdle of beyond a reasonable doubt, and they decide to vote not guilty, now you've acquitted this person and you can never try that person again. And if down the line more evidence comes forward, it's game over for you. You've already had your trial and you've lost, and there's nothing that you can do now. And that, I think, is one of the reasons amongst some, but one of the more powerful reasons of why they may not prosecute a case that does not seem like a home run, because they're concerned with the consequences if they do lose. Now, that all being said, not every case is perfect. In fact, most cases are not perfect. Most cases have a lot of problems with them. But it's a prosecutor's responsibility to sit down and go, okay, everything good that we have and everything weak that we have in this case, do we feel confident we could prove this beyond a reasonable doubt? And that is really the seminal question they need to answer before bringing a prosecution. And that's why sometimes they don't take that chance.
Cook County State's attorney claims ethical guidelines prohibit the charging of a case without evidence in hand that would enable them to prove guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Let's bring back investigative journalist Doug Longini. Doug, how did the Boccaccio family react to this?
Thought immediately comes to mind, thinking about the DNA match to Michael Gargiulo and the failure, or the refusal, I should put it, of the Cook County State's attorney to bring charges against him based upon the DNA match. So what comes to mind is, well, what was the reaction of the Boccaccio? Well, initially none. They were kept in the dark for, I think, 3 or 4 years, at least 3 years. They never even knew any of this was going on. Nobody told them there'd been a match. Nobody told them anything. It wasn't until 2006 that they learned there had been this match. You know, I wasn't with them at the time, and I've seen them many times in the last number of years, the last 10 years at least, and they can get pretty upset about things. I can't even guess how upset they were when they found that out. I mean, at last, after all that time, there'd been a DNA match, something I'm sure in their private thoughts and prayers they'd hoped for. And there it was, and the state's attorney refused to bring charges. They had to have been devastated. Had to be.
Can you imagine, here's a family who lost their beautiful, bright, young daughter, and according to the mother, she was always checking on the status of the case, but not knowing for 2 years that there was DNA, and also the fact of what was going on in the case, to potentially be left in the dark. How that must felt for the family, wanting answers after so many years, and still, in their mind, not getting any answers. It had to be devastating. Tom, were you there when the Boccaccio family found out? How did they learn there'd be no charges laid?
Yeah, I was doing some additional follow-ups in Illinois. I met up, first of all, with Lou Sala and some of the several of the investigators that worked with him. Another guy by the name of Nick D'Tuzza. Nick, real squared away guy. He's retired too. And I wanted to talk with some of their witnesses for additional background that maybe I could use that information to pull stuff from my witnesses to maybe solidify the case a little bit better in Ellerin. And I'll say this, they really didn't want me to talk to a lot of their people. So I'll just leave it at that. But I did talk to their witnesses, a lot of them. And I decided I'm going to talk to the Boccaccio family, because I was led, I was told directly that the Illinois State's attorney sat down with the family with high level rank and file of Cook County sheriffs. And they were told that there was no evidence linking any suspects to their daughter's case. And I wanted to get a little bit more on the relationship they had with Gargiulo. And I wasn't going to be stopped from doing that. So my partner and I established a plan, and I got a hold of Mr. Picasso, and I established a date and time for a meeting, and I left it up to them where they felt the safest. And he was always wondering, why does a Los Angeles police detective want to talk to them about their daughter's case from Illinois? So I said, well, I got some information that I'd like to share with you and kind of pick your brain on some aspects of your daughter's case. So we met, and they said, now what's this all about? And I said, well, first of all, what do you know about Trisha's case? And they said, well, they don't have anybody in mind. They're still working it, but they said there's no evidence of anybody. And I said, well, I'm gonna tell you something, and it's gonna floor you. But the reason I'm here is I've got linkage between a case that we have in Los Angeles with your daughter's case, and the linkage is DNA. And that's how they found out. So I, they were none too happy. I'll say that, but they were almost relieved. And I think Mrs. Picasso in particular, she blurted out that she always felt Michael Gargiulo had something to do with that case. And her husband also believed that, but he was so taken aback and so, because he is the one that found his daughter. So he has a lot of issues that he still carries to this day, trying to get through this. But I felt that they should know that there is evidence, and we're looking at their daughter's case. And I needed help with that case to further bolster the Ellerman case. You see that reasoning? Because we can do a thing under 1101B of the evidence code, when you have a case that is so similar in MO and the way it's carried out, that you can use that in your case in chief in California. A lot of states don't have that, but we have that here. And so I was able to glean a lot of information. And from there, I got names and places of different people to talk to, and it brought about a lot of very good background information on what Gargiulo is all about and how he operates. And literally, we actually turned up about 30 actual felonies that he committed that were never charged. Things like arsons and car theft and robberies and burglaries and rapes. The guy is he's a bad seed.
With Cook County choosing not to charge Gargiulo, he remained a free man in California. Sadly, 2 years later, another Los Angeles woman was killed in a similar brutal fashion. In our next episode, we dive deeper into that murder, key evidence recovered from the crime scene, and Gargiulo's eventual move to Santa Monica. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper.